This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The city is expected to send out the first citations in its long-awaited crackdown on illegal vacation rentals this week. This comes as a second lawsuit has been filed over the enforcement. It was filed on behalf of the Waikiki Banyan, which has been operating as a condotel. It's apparently not in the resort district, so owners are in a bit of a fix. If you step into the lobby of the Twin Towers located off Kuhio, it's not unlike a hotel. Take a listen. That was a family dragging its luggage through the lobby on their way to their hotel rooms. It sounds like a hotel, looks like a hotel, but the Waikiki Banyan is a bit of an odd duck. Aston manages the units it owns and operates a front desk, but several other companies manage other condo units. It doesn't look much different than the Marriott Waikiki, which is right next door and in the resort special district. Hence the dilemma, so it's turning to the courts for guidance. The suit was filed Friday afternoon in state court. We talked to GM Tom Lonigro this morning about the situation.
Well, it is kind of a unique building in a way. It's basically designed as a resort. It looks like a resort. If you're driving down Kuhio, you look at it, it looks like any other hotel. As you know, when you came in, you've seen that it has a lobby, which is manned 24/7 from Aston, who is a partner in partnership with the association. So we look like a hotel, we act like a hotel, we provide hotel services, and that's the way we've been operating since 1979.
Okay, and you've got two twin towers, and how many rooms?
We have 876 units.
And they're all the same?
They're all the same.
Okay, so talk about the concern that the condo owners have with this new enforcement action that the city's taken.
We have about 89% of the units within Waikiki Banyan are vacation rentals. So 89% of our ownership had asked that the association take action, file a lawsuit against the city and county and DPP, file an injunction to at least put a temporary stay on the ordinance. What this would do is, if the ordinance went through, is it would put an economic impact on all of our owners by way of reducing their income, and also it would reduce the number of units that are legally that have the NUCs. It would take them out of the Aston pool, which would have a direct impact on the financial viability of the building.
To your knowledge, have any of the owners gotten any letters from the city?
I know of none as of yet. I have reached out to the owners and asked them if they have gotten any letters, if they would report them, but I have yet to receive any information that any of the owners have received a violation letter.
So at the heart of this issue is that you're technically not in the resort district, I guess.
We're in the residential precinct of Waikiki.
Okay, but at no time did the city say, hey, you're in the wrong area, you shouldn't be renting out?
We've never heard anything from that. We've been operating in this manner since 1979.
Okay, and then do you have a court hearing date yet?
That I don't know. I know that they filed an injunction and went in on Friday.
Have you lost any bookings, or how does that work for advertising?
Well, because I manage the Association of Apartment Owners, and the way that this ordinance kind of goes in, it's geared more towards the vacation rental units. We don't actually manage any of those units. They're all individually managed, or they're put into the different operators' pools. And the way it's affecting them is a lot of them, because they can't advertise, as the ordinance says, that you have to have your non-conforming unit citation number attached to any advertisements, and if not, that's going to be the mechanism on how they issue the violations and the fines. So out of 876 units, we have 179 units that have the non-conforming use certifications, and you can just understand the economic impact that that's going to have.
I'm sure you have a lot of worried property owners.
Well, we do. People who invested in these units, they bought into it thinking that it's an investment. This place has been operating as a condotel since 1979. There is no conceivable idea that this was going to be taken away from them. You know, so now their investments are in jeopardy.
And so you're asking for clarification from the court, some guidance.
Correct. We're filing for an injunction. We just want to keep the status quo for now until the city and county can go back, take a look at the ordinance, maybe make some adjustments to it. I understand the concept of it. The concept was to look at the neighborhoods and the impact that it was going to have on the infrastructure in the neighborhoods like Kailua or Hawaikai. But this is Waikiki. We have the infrastructure. It's structured to have the tourism that we have. There's no impact. There's no additional impact that for the Banyans to operate in the same manner that it has been operating for the past 40 years. In fact, the Waikiki Banyan has a unique situation. By Waikiki Banyans operating in the manner that we have been operating in, we provide a service to families. This is a family hotel that has kitchenettes that families from the mainland can come over that otherwise couldn't come over and stay at some place, say, like the Hilton, because they have the opportunity to bring their families in. They can cook. They don't have to go out to eat at restaurants. So the economic impact for them is huge.
Are your property owners a mix of local and the mainland investors?
It is. We reached out to the DPP and had a meeting prior to the law taking effect. It was uneventful. So we filed an injunction.
Anybody else that you've heard of? Any other entity in Waikiki that might be doing something similar?
I don't know. I know that at one point we were reaching out to some other buildings that were like ours. You know, we basically went through this on our own because it's our self-interest that we're looking out for.
Right. We were talking to the Waikiki Banyan's general manager, Tom Lonigrow, this morning about the situation with the vacation rentals and the lawsuit that they filed late Friday afternoon. Last week, Mayor Kirk Caldwell and Kathy Sogugawa of the Department of Planning and Permitting underscored their intent to enforce the new law in spite of any legal challenge.
We are going to be enforcing Bill 89 that I signed into law about a month and a half ago. If you have a vacation rental that is less than 30 days, that you don't have a non-conforming use permit for, that is not in a hotel and resort area, you've been violating law since the 1980s, and under the law that I just signed, you continue to violate the law. The difference is now we can use social media platforms to find out what you're doing and to crack down. And we're in fact investigating a couple hundred violations right now. And we're going to make sure that when we send out the notice of violation, it is correct, accurate, and that we're going to succeed if they persist on advertising illegally and having illegal vacation rental. It's as simple and as clear as that. And I don't want anyone out there who has an illegal vacation rental to think that because of this lawsuit or others that may be filed in the future, that the City and County of Honolulu is not going to enforce the laws that have been enacted by the Honolulu City Council and signed into law by the mayor. We're asking people, instead of having us have to issue a notice of violation if you have a vacation rental for less than 30 days, that you come into compliance with the law. And in October of next year in 2020, that you can apply for a registration number for a bed and breakfast if you're one of those folks. But unhosted outside of a resort area without a non-conforming use permit, you are violating the law, clear and simple.
We've never let up on investigation. We've always been committed to enforcing the new law. We're actively doing our investigation to confirm the evidence so that we can stand by our NOVs. Again, we're still in the research phase. We want to make absolutely sure the citation that we use in the notice of violation, that we have the correct information, the correct owner, the correct section of the LUO or the bill, Ordinance 1918, that we need to include. We want to include actual evidence with the NOV so that it's irrefutable that we do have a notice of violation.
That was DPP's Kathy Sogugawa and Mayor Kirk Caldwell talking about enforcement of the vacation rental rules now on the books. Our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat is about a story concerning visitors who are caught up in that vacation rental crackdown. Reporter Christina Jedra on the line this morning. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Yes. So glad you could join us. So tell us about the people that you've talked to about how they've been impacted by this.
Yeah, so a lot of tourists are sort of scrambling this month. With the crackdown on short-term vacation rentals, a lot of operators have started taking down their ads. Some of them are putting their units up for sale or for rent. Others are just still figuring out what to do. So for tourists, that means they got messages from their host saying, "We're sorry, we just can't host you anymore." And this is happening sometimes days or weeks before people's trips. So it's been surprising and frustrating for them. Some of the visitors have tried to sweet talk their hosts into hosting them anyway, but the city is really threatening some heavy fines here, up to $10,000 a day for recurring violations. So for a lot of property owners, it's just not worth the risk.
And one of the folks that you highlighted was someone who was planning a wedding.
Yes, one local bride, two of her bridesmaids now have to stay on the mainland. They just can't afford to stay in a hotel. They had, booked an Airbnb. They got the cancellation, and it's unfortunate for that bride. She's pretty upset about it. So it affects, local folks as well as our visitors.
Yes, and weddings are already an emotional time, and then you add this.
Right. Yes, to hear weeks, ahead of the event that there's this big upheaval in your plans is, one bride from Arizona said she had a full-on panic attack. It's not what you want when you're planning a wedding, but this is in some ways welcome news for some people that just want to see fewer tourists on Oahu. Tourism numbers have been rising, spending has been stagnant, and some folks just want to see fewer tourists, and the tourists that we have maybe spending more money, those higher spending folks that may stay in a resort and spend a lot of money at a restaurant instead of staying in an Airbnb and cooking for themselves.
Are there folks that you talk to that are just going to bite the bullet and just stay at a hotel, which is maybe more expensive?
The folks that I talk to actually have not booked hotels. They've kind of found ways around it. So the bride from Arizona, she did end up finding someone to rent to her. She said a friend on Oahu will let her stay. She's a little nervous that there could still be enforcement. I'm not sure of the legality of that one, but fingers crossed for her. Another gentleman from Oregon, his host initially canceled on him. And then when, he expressed his dismay, she took pity on him and said, you can stay for free. Because she just felt bad that it was so last minute. But that particular guy said, why do I want to spend all the money to come to Hawaii and spend money on a hotel when I can use that money? And it'll be stretched a lot further if I go to Mexico instead. So some people are planning future trips elsewhere.
I know when we talked to the DPP a couple of weeks ago, they said they were fielding lots of calls from like the people like you talked to who were saying, hey, I've got this place booked and what do I do? And
right.
And then they've also had calls from people who were saying, just give us a grace period because we're booked through the end of the year.
Yeah, some people have been saying, can you give us a break? This is so last minute. And DPP is really saying, no, this is the law now. This is what we're enforcing. There are a lot of people, including the tourists I talked to, that are saying, why couldn't this have gone in effect, January 1st to let us, act out the bookings that we already had? And move forward from there. But no, this is happening now. It's August 1st, and the listings have decreased. They decreased 37% on the second day the law took effect. So it's happening now.
Yes, I have been actually jumping online, both on the Airbnb and VRBO websites, as well as Craigslist. And I can definitely see how the numbers have dropped. There are none in my neighborhood that are being advertised anymore.
Yeah. And a lot of them, it seems, are being converted to, sales or long-term leases. I did speak with Zillow, and it's very preliminary right now, but they did say they saw a spike in July, the month after the law was passed, a spike in ads for sale and for leases. And they hadn't seen a jump up like that in like 4 years. So there are some indications that the law is acting as intended to kind of convert these units back to housing for locals, but we'll have to kind of wait and see what the long-term effects will be.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Christina. It's an interesting sidebar to this whole saga that's unfolding. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
That was reporter Christina Jedra, a new addition to Honolulu Civil Beat. To read her stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're talking baseball. More specifically, we explore the short-lived Hawaiian Winter League. For 8 years, the league drew big names like Jason Giambi and Aaron Boone to Hawaii's shores to play ball during the MLB's off-season. Escaping the cold mainland winters, big-name stars flocked to the Aloha State to ply their trade, along with stars from Japan and Korea's major leagues, the NPB and the KBO. Now, teams like the Maui Stingrays or the Kauai Emeralds duked it out for bragging rights as Hawaii's top semi-pro baseball club. Perhaps the biggest star of the NPB, however, was the NPB and MLB legend Ichiro Suzuki. Before his legendary exploits as one of the most accomplished hitters, he played a single season for the Hilo Stars in 1993 at the age of 19, making waves as one of the Hawaiian Winter League's most exciting players. Among his accomplishments during that time with the Hilo Stars was a home run that the young slugger hit, a supposedly 500-foot moonshot that cemented his legacy as one of the Hawaiian Winter League's greatest alumni. Now, today's Backyard Quiz is for the true baseball buffs listening. What was the nickname given to the 500-foot home run that Ichiro Suzuki hit in his only season for the Hilo Stars? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Shem Lawler from Blue Planet Foundation. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
As the TMT standoff stretches into its second month, astronomers who withdrew from the mountain are looking forward to getting back to work. Here to talk about the latest activity tied to Mauna Kea is HPR's Ku'uwei Hirayoshi. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So on any given day up on Mauna Kea, we see anywhere from 50 to 70 employees actually going up Monday through Friday, and another several hundred that stay down in the base facility, admin staff and whatnot. So we should see a lot of traffic going up to Mauna Kea this week. But we wanted to look more deeper into the astronomy sector here in Hawaii, specifically dealing with jobs. So the most recent figures that we have is this 2014 report by UH's Economic Research Organization. And it shows that around roughly nearly 1,400 jobs, astronomy sector and astronomy related jobs are here statewide in Hawaii. So a pretty big one of the biggest astronomy sectors in the country. So second really only to California, who has Caltech and Palomar Observatory. So lots of employees there. But supporters of the 30-meter telescope are saying that if the telescope isn't built, that, you know, it could jeopardize sort of future jobs and the future of astronomy here in Hawaii. So we wanted to get deeper into that. Got to speak to Kiloha Pishoda, whose name a lot of folks out there might be recognized, because she is one of the leaders of the group calling themselves Kia'i or Protectors of Mauna Kea. But before that, she spent about a decade working as a telescope tech up at the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. And she's skeptical of this promise of jobs.
I just think that that's not really in evidence. And if it were, we would be doing really well since 1968, since astronomy's been up there. I mean, I did work for the British government. I worked in the science division. there was only two other Hawaiians on the British telescope, and I think very low numbers of local people.
So that has been a challenge for that particular sector, is finding highly qualified local residents to fill some of these positions. So I think it was interesting to look for statistics on this, because not a lot of people are following this. But back in 2007, so a very dated survey done by UH, University of Hawaii, found that only about 18%, 1/8 of the astronomy observatories, technical and administrative staff based on Hawaii Island were actually born on that island. And I think in total, another 33% were residents of the state. So maybe not born here, but at least, you know, the money is going back into the community here and the economy here. Since this has been a challenge for that particular sector, a longtime Hawaii veteran astronomer, Doug Simons, who's been here for nearly 30 years, career up on Mauna Kea, current executive director of the Canada-France Hawaii Telescope. This has been his focus. He's at that point in his career where he wants to make sure that any future jobs up on the mountain can be secured by a local residence because they have access to these sort of world-renowned telescopes. So this has kind of been his baby. He started a program called Mauna Kea Scholars in partnership with the other observatories up there. So the observatories give free observatory time to high school kids. It's a multi-year program. And to sort of just get them in the door and show them that they can have this opportunity, this career in astronomy, and you have access right in your backyard. Doug is actually, R. Simons is working on the Mauna Kea Scholars Program, which he believes is sort of the front of that pipeline to get more local residents into astronomy.
It's so satisfying to, in particular with the Mauna Kea Scholar Program, to see these kids submit their observing proposals just like, quote, real astronomers. So I literally read every observing proposal submitted by all these schools across, we've got them on six islands now. It is so fun to go, for example, Molokai. Those kids, have never, ever had the opportunity to participate in Hawaii astronomy. Those schools in particular are important to me because I grew up in a real small town, and I was thinking how much I would have loved to have access to Palomar Observatory. That was pre-Mauna Kea, and how transformative that could have been for me. So that's kind of, for me, the beginning of the pipeline.
Right. So these high school students, they get field mentors. So graduate students from the Institute for Astronomy throughout this process, they can take their observation data, I guess, and turn it into a science fair project. So lots of opportunities that are sort of we're seeing kind of that pipeline, the beginning of the pipeline, grow, and hopefully will move into the jobs that are up there on the mountain right now.
Yeah, I think recently we put the spotlight on Pisces, and I know they were talking about a space camp they had for young girls to try and get them encourage them to get into the science field. And it makes sense, and I know they're trying to get into the schools in the younger grades as well.
Right. And I think that the idea of the 30-meter telescope has already invested about $5 million in STEM education and opportunities like this for these students. So when we think about how we're going to build that pipeline, that investment is something that's weighing on folks' minds. But I also got to talk, it's nothing like a conversation with an economist to kind of sift through all this data. Carl Bonham, our economics professor up at UH, but also executive director of UH's economic research organization, who put out this report. He says statewide in that initial report in 2012, we were seeing about $170 million of investment from astronomy-related activities. So it going back into the economy. And for him, when we talk about job numbers and economic impact of astronomy, he says it's a little bit bigger than that.
Really, you really shouldn't be focusing on just the size of the industry in terms of its output or how many jobs. It's the nature of the industry that's so important, in that we're essentially bringing money in from the rest of the world. It's an export good.
Right. So that idea that we are producing research up in these telescopes, world-renowned research that can also go back into our economy. He also talked about spillover jobs, which was interesting because according to Simons, at least, when you talk about the amount of scientists or astronomers actually in this workforce of 1,300, we're really only seeing about 15% of that is actually, you know, the astronomers up with this, all this data, all of its like technical support. So technicians that actually operate the telescopes, engineers that work on instruments or the telescope itself. Those are the jobs that we're trying to look at filling. But Bonham also says that in terms of the economy right now, when we talk about economic diversification, right, getting off of tourism, which we know has been our dependent, right, dependence right now in Hawaii, that astronomy is sort of that perfect key for that.
The bottom line is that in terms of real spending, tourism hasn't shown any real growth since the 90s. We're basically at, I mean, this is kind of hard for people to believe, but in terms of how much is actually being spent in the economy by tourists in real dollars, it's about the same today as it was in 1990, 1991. In other words, that's not what's causing our economy to grow. And so, you know, having these other sectors that can contribute and, you know, high, good paying, high skill jobs is crucial to our future.
This is a very interesting sort of idea when you think about the economy and where astronomy is going in the future in that sort of all the other, you know, industries that we have here in Hawaii.
I'm kind of surprised that that the scientists don't have better data about, you know, what you looked at instead of just the older numbers. I mean, I'm just struck, and I think lots of people are, is how organized the anti-side is. You know, we've had lots of activities this weekend. There was a march on Maui. I think the surfers did a whole campaign. And then Tulsi Gabbard showed up on the mountain also this weekend.
That's right. And organization has been, I think, it's made a big difference for those in that camp. And I think that on the scientist side, we may hopefully see better data and more recent data to help us make a better decision.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking to Kuvei Hiraishi about getting back to work on the mountain. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites you to a screening of Moana Nui a Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Sunday, August 18th in Waimea on Hawaii Island, Sunday, August 25th in Honolulu, and Saturday, August 31st in Lihue. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Dawson.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we're very fortunate to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week's stargazers, look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southwestern sky after sunset. Both planets are bright and easy to spot. The moon this week is passing through its full phase, and so spotting faint objects in the heavens is going to be very challenging indeed, especially if you're looking to spot the Perseid meteors in the annual Perseid meteor shower, which peaks at the beginning of the week.
Turns out somebody was looking around, and it was an amateur astronomer who possibly caught an explosion happening somewhere in our solar system. Do I have it right?
Yes, you do. They captured images of Jupiter and what appears to be an explosion occurring in the upper atmosphere on August the 8th. These images show a bright event that fades rapidly over time, and this is exactly what we'd expect to see if a large object such as an asteroid or comet were to collide with this massive planet.
And my limited understanding is that there are small collisions involving Jupiter that are so somewhat common, but something like you're describing seems a bit out of the ordinary.
Well, we estimate that small objects with a diameter of around 20 foot or so collide with Jupiter several times a month, but large ones like this occur pretty much once or twice every decade. So this is definitely not an everyday occurrence.
Why do you think Jupiter is this magnet for impacts? I can't imagine that it's something the planet is doing to cause. Or is it?
Well, actually, it is. The answer is its gravity. Jupiter is massive, and massive objects generate enormous gravitational fields. Jupiter's gravitational field is a monster, so much so that it captures objects from all over the solar system as it orbits the sun.
I get also what you're saying. It's just larger, so it's a bigger target, easier to hit.
Yeah, it sure is.
And I guess I'm reading into it, and you'll correct me if I have this entirely wrong, but does that make it kind of like an ally to Earth because it's absorbing some of the potential asteroids that might hit our little planet?
You're absolutely right. It does indeed. In fact, it's one of the wondrous and indirect aspects of Jupiter's existence, and it's possible that we may owe our continued existence to the imposing gravitational presence of this majestic celestial giant.
Does that mean we should start naming more tributes and stuff to Jupiter all over Earth as kind of like our... hey, thanks. Thanks for taking
that. It wouldn't be a bad idea.
It's Christopher Phillips and a fun and very enlightening Stargazer report. And thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer, which you can find at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we asked our listeners to dig deep into some Hawaii baseball knowledge. For a single season in 1993, Japanese baseball star Ichiro Suzuki played for the Hilo Stars in the now-defunct Hawaiian Winter Baseball League. His stats for the season were impressive. In 183 at-bats, he boasted a .366 batting average, 67 hits, 8 home runs, and 22 runs batted in all at the age of 19. His legacy in the short-lived Hawaiian League was catapulted to legendary status with the help of a single home run. No ordinary run-of-the-mill home run, mind you, but a 500-foot moonshot hit far beyond the fence line of the Les Murakami Stadium, where a majority of the league's games were played. Thanks to this feat of slugging, Ichiro Suzuki, later known simply as Ichiro, became a legend of the Hawaiian Winter Baseball League. And the home run he belted became known as the Shinkansen Homer, named for the 200-mile-an-hour bullet train that runs through much of Japan. Ichiro went on to boast an over 20-year career in the Japanese and American majors, spent mostly with the Oryx Blue Wave and the Seattle Mariners. He boasted multiple MVP selections, Golden Glove titles, and All-Star appearances, yet before all of that, one might argue that the career of one of the game's greatest living players started right here in Hawaii. And congratulations to Nikhila Nanda. You got it right. You hit a home run. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And Shane Victorino hopes to hit a home run with a new venture build around hemp. The Flying Hawaiian is investing in the future of the crop that will go from seed to sale with an eye to future export markets. Arcadia Biosciences is one of 30 companies who secured permits under a pilot program with the Agriculture Department. There are still hurdles to scale with the State Health Department and the federal government. We talked with Victorino and Matt Plavin, who's with the Arcadia Biosciences, about what's ahead.
Arcadia Biosciences is a company that has been transforming plants and improving the quality and the output of crops for many years. And with the legalization of hemp as a result of the 2018 Farm Bill, we were evaluating how best to enter the markets and which markets to enter. And it became clear to us that Hawaii is a really unique opportunity for hemp for a number of reasons. From a climate standpoint, it's a great place to target such a productive crop, number one. And number two, it really represents a tremendous opportunity for the Hawaiian community with regard to having a viable, innovative, new agricultural opportunity. So it really brings an opportunity for agricultural prosperity. And when we evaluated, you know, how do we come into a community that we're not part of, we were evaluating that. And once we learned that Shane Victorino was available as not only a partner to invest with us, but someone who shared this vision of bringing agricultural prosperity to Hawaii, we have saw that there was a great partnership opportunity. So after just a little bit of conversation about how we would come together, it seemed like the perfect marriage, bringing high science and scientific integrity in crop innovation together with someone who is well-regarded and revered in the Hawaiian and trusted in the Hawaiian community, who also happens to have a partnership and a relationship with an extraction company in Arizona. It's an expert at quality extraction of hemp and hemp derivative products. We just decided that this was a marriage made in heaven, and it was something that we were very excited about from the get-go, and it took a little while to kind of put all the pieces together. But as you mentioned, just a few days ago, we announced this partnership. And so we now have what we call a one vertically integrated supply chain for Hawaiian hemp production and formulation.
Now, I was out there in Waimanalo when they showed off the hemp plants, and they were crazy big.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's the thing about hemp is right now, and this is why we're so well positioned for this opportunity. You know, hemp and cannabis has been illegal in the States for 70 years. So when you look at crops like corn, wheat, soybean, I mean, when you drive past a cornfield, what do you see? You see perfectly level field of corn. Every stalk looks the same. It's because there's little genetic diversity in that crop because it's been optimized over the years to perform and maximize yields. Because cannabis has been illegal, there's really not been that kind of breeding and modern agricultural tools that have been applied to improving the genome for cannabis. So you're right. You drive past a hemp field, you'll see a hemp plant that's 10 feet tall. You'll see one that's 2 feet tall and 3 feet wide. So although there's a tremendous demand for the hemp and the hemp derivative products, the reality is that the state of the genetics in hemp today is suboptimized pretty substantially. So we're coming into the market using our genetic experience to try and, you know, quickly as we can, improve the varieties and the strains so that farmers, you know, as this industry grows and competition becomes a much more significant factor, that the farmers, and in this particular case, the farmers in Hawaii, are equipped with the best genetics to continue profiting and building their businesses over time as this market matures.
And Shane, talk about your interest in this, because I know at the time when Representative Cynthia Thielen was really pushing for this, and it's been decades, you know, she talked about everything from construction materials to, you know, fabric. But what's your interest in this?
I think it's an opportunity for me, obviously, retiring from baseball. You know, an opportunity from an individual that I've known since I first started my launch of my career, and he basically said to me, you know, this is a space that you should look into. You know, you're done with baseball. I think it's a space that can help the agricultural cultivation and restoring some of the, you know, the soils that have been absolutely, you know, tarnished over the years from pineapple fields and sugarcane and the, you know, all the things that have gone into the, you know, the soil and, you know, learning about hemp. And it literally started a year ago, and it started just like that, literally one text, and it sparked my interest from that day on. And I've looked into facilities, you know, obviously living in Vegas full time and seeing where cannabis has gone, and, you know, now the CBD space opening up. And, you know, so I really took on the challenge to learn, do my due diligence, research, and obviously, like Matt said, it's been in the making of an opportunity to look at how we can best come into the state of Hawaii and basically give local families, local farmers, and basically an agricultural, you know, opportunity to the state of Hawaii, and basically, you know, even having conversation with the governor and saying, you know, is this something that someday will you know, become a reality? And again, hey, we all understand from a federal standpoint, there's things that still need to be adjusted, and I think we all understand that. And, you know, obviously, you know, this venture has kind of jumped ahead of the curve in regard to what is really happening and the bylaws that are going on back home. And but again, it's for me, understanding one thing, if the local families have a chance to obviously benefit, create, you know, an opportunity to generate revenue off the land that we have, because land is precious. And I get that's been my biggest concern, is every piece of land that we have on the island is slowly being used up and is being given away or is taken away from us. And it's at that point where, can this be an opportunity where local families take their land that they're selling to, you know, make a living and to move on and come to places like Las Vegas, where I live, and make home? You know, if this gives them an opportunity, and that's what's really exciting me about this, other than the fact that I get to come home and hopefully help local families. And that's my biggest obstacle in all this is understand one thing. That's all I'm coming in for, and why my venture has been started, and why I want to do what I do.
Now, the whole CBD thing, I know it's taken off, but we're waiting for some federal rules to clarify the situation.
There's no doubt the demand for CBD is enormous, and it's growing at a staggering rate. But to your point, you know, the FDA's responsibility is to protect consumers. And I think what is one of their greatest concerns is how, you know, the claims that companies are making, you know, health claims, the medical claims that really are unfounded and inappropriate. And so, you know, the FDA is evaluating how to regulate this. And we as a public company and our joint venture, you know, we are steadfast committed to maintaining compliance with local and federal laws. So it's really important, and we're staying abreast of those. It's really important to, you know, for us to develop our plans and our commercialization strategies, but we're going to deploy those according to the rules and regulations as they're issued. But there's no doubt the consumers have a strong demand for CBD, and that we have to tread carefully and make sure that we understand labeling laws and formulation laws as we enter the market. We began our first plantings April 1st. We've had our initial harvest in July, and we're continuing to kind of expand into our full 10 acres because each of the pilot programs is 10 acres. And we've been evaluating a number of the department's strains of hemp, evaluating the genetics. We've been doing breeding in preparation for targeting, you know, ways to improve the strains that exist today, and, you know, which strains perform the best in the Hawaiian climate. So this pilot program has been a great way for us to get boots on the ground and understand the agronomics of the available strains, and provide that information back to the Department of Agriculture in partnership with them to, again, prepare for the scale-up of this industry, which we think Hawaii is really well positioned to lead in. The first thing that needs to happen is the USDA needs to issue their guidelines to the states for the implementation of the 2018 Farm Bill. The states then submit their plans to the USDA as to how they're going to comply with those regulations, and then the USDA has 60 days to turn around and approve those plans. Nobody expects that these will be difficult procedures. It's pretty well understood from the bill itself what the program will look like, but that is still the process that needs to unfold, and everybody's speculating as to how quickly that will occur. Some people think it'll happen by the end of 19. Some think it'll be the first quarter maybe of 2020. But once that happens, then it'll be very clear for farmers, you know, how they will comply with the regulations and the ability to expand beyond the current pilot phase, for example, in Hawaii, will open up. So that's really what needs to happen before we can scale beyond the pilot program that we're all operating under at the moment. We see an enormous opportunity in the Asian markets, and we feel really well positioned in Hawaii to serve those markets. So between the Hawaiian market and what we think the export markets are, we're pretty excited about the ability to create employment and diversify the economy in a pretty meaningful way between the Hawaiian market and the export market. Exactly how it ends up funneling through the retail channels is, I think, yet to be determined. We're going to be able to control quality from the time we put a seed in the ground to the time the product is formulated and sold as a wholesale to a retailer. And so that's a lot of work for us from now until these rules come out. So we're going to be busy developing those capabilities. And, you know, based upon those estimates that I referred to earlier, you know, late 19, early 2020, that's about the time we'll be ready with our full supply chain. So we're feeling pretty good about our prospects to kind of enter the market or be ready to enter the market just as those rules are coming out. But I think there's somewhere between 8 and 12 different varieties or strains that the Department of Agriculture has made available to the licensees. And they're all quite different. Mm-hmm. And we're all looking for different things. We, Archipelago Ventures, happen to be looking specifically for CBD content and other features that we believe are optimal characteristics. And I think there are some strains there that we can work with. There are others that are more challenging. As you probably know, when the cannabis plant is in its growth cycle, it can be kind of finicky with regard to the level of certain cannabinoids over the growth cycle. For example, if there's excessive heat, you may end up with more THC than is allowable. And as you probably also know, and maybe if some listeners don't know, the distinction between marijuana and hemp is 0.3% THC and below. So within this pilot program, there's a pretty rigid quality control and restrictions and reporting requirements to make sure that if any licensees' plants are testing above 0.3%, those have to be destroyed because they're illegal at that point. So from the standpoint of looking at the strains and identifying those that you want to pursue for the production of hemp and CBD, you're really looking for those strains that you're confident or you can be confident will grow and yield well without exceeding that 0.3% THC. So I think that's what we're all looking at from the standpoint of licensees evaluating available varieties for production and scale up.
For me, it's an option and an opportunity to understand what really happens. I was never a farmer. I was never, but I obviously with research and continuing our progression and moving forward and looking, with forward thinking, how do I learn from farmers who have dealt with that kind of crops being stolen? What are some of the things that have happened? But I mean, by the bylaws, I think you have to, be very, as Matt said, listening to what he was saying is you have to very, obviously have security around the place. You have to double fence it. Not for just purposes of just these as, hey, on Molokai, you got deer that can jump over and run through a patch and destroy something. So there's so many other things than just, the person that can destroy a crop or that, weather aspect. So I think this is an ever, for us, I think it's an ever revolving door. Obviously there's research that has been done since, back in the days of UH and all the research that they have done, with, like you said, people who have been a part of this a lot longer than I have and understanding conversations with them that, hey, we're all going to learn along the way and we're going to, understand one another. And I think the ultimate thing for me in all of this is we got to work together. And I think the state benefits as a whole. And hopefully this is a change for our agricultural, identification. And, this can be, as I said, the sugar cane what it once was and what the pineapple fields once were. If this is what, hopefully we scientific research and all the things that continue to grow, makes this, and continues to make this a reality.
And did you get any advice from your dad?
Other than work hard, son, you've always done that. My dad identifies himself and, it's one thing I love to share about that is that, from a father to son thing, we've always kept ourselves in different pots. My dad has never told me what to do and I've never told my dad what to do, but we've always agreed that when we say yes to something and we commit to it, we give 100%. If we fail, we fail. But one thing that we're going to give 100%. So that's the only advice that dad had to me starting this venture. He goes, son, I know you know what you're doing. You've done a lot of work. I know you've been, you know, doing as much as you can and taking in a lot of as many conversations as you have. My only advice to you is work hard and do the right thing by the people. And if it's the right thing to do, then I think we're all, you know, we're all in it together. So, you know, that's how I've attacked this venture. And I think that's the only way for me to look at this venture. And as one thing is that I'm getting an opportunity. Hey, I did one thing as an athlete, but I'd love to come home and help as a, you know, a now retired athlete and someone who loves the Islands more than anything, to come back home and help these families and, you know, deal with what we deal with every day at home, you know, finding ways to make our economy go.
That was Shane Victorino and Matt Plavin, who are behind a test hempla on Molokai. Arcadia secured a permit this spring and just last week announced it signed on Victorino. Shane's father, Mike, happens to be mayor of Maui.
Coming Saturday, August 17th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's an evening of slack key guitar, classic as well as not so traditional, when local virtuoso Stephen Inglis joins us for a solo performance. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco. The hottest time was had by
all. We got to go now, but up tomorrow, we hear about the progress tackling the infestation of coconut rhinoceros beetle on city land. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Hawaii Talks.